Good afternoon, world. Welcome to Tragedy and Hope. It's been a long time since I had Richard Grove on the show, and I'm very happy, always, to have him back on the show. And Rich, I don't know if you saw the article I sent you on your friend there, Mr. Greenberg, over at AIG, going before the courts or not.
No, I didn't get a chance to check email. But yeah, what was the article about? Enlighten me.
Well, it wasn't about his crimes on 9/11, but it was some other fraud that AIG had pulled off, and Morris Greenberg finally going to court on some charges. So I thought that was interesting.
Well, I'm sure. I mean, I haven't obviously dug into that yet, but I wouldn't be surprised to find the judge in that case being sponsored by AIG at some point in their career and that sort of thing. Like, just because he's in court, I think that's more for public appearances than it is for actually, you know, truth and justice in the American way in this country.
Well, truth and justice in the American way went away a long time ago in this country.
Greenberg made out like a bandit during those the bailouts and stuff, right? Didn't he? Like he loaned money and got money back, or you know, paid back the government money in record time.
Right. I think that was part of what it was about. But you know, I sent that out. God, it has to be a month ago, so I don't even remember because the news keeps me way too busy to stay on one story anymore.
Oh, yeah, totally. But in the case of Greenberg and those guys and the bailouts, I think it's a case of they discovered that instead of trying to hide what they're doing, just do it in public and make up some lame excuse like, oh, these are bailouts and we have to pay to keep these banks in business. And what most people don't know is that I think, you know, taxpayers across America have to pay like $93 billion a year to keep those banks in business.
That's just ridiculous. Anyway, Rich, you haven't been on the show in a long time. I'm sure you're following the especially as a New Yorker, with the New York bombing that happened last week. At the same time, of course, we got nailed for illegal bombing in Syria and killing Syrian troops. So I thought that – I said, wow, this looks like a cover-up, looked like Boston all over again.
Yeah, I mean, I try to keep an open mind during these things, during these events as you see them unfold, and I don't really keep up with mainstream media, but I do tune in to see what they're telling people when these events happen. You know, I spent several years in New York City, and it's tragic to see these events going on there. But I think that when you find out that the people that they're catching have already had meetings and contacts and are known to the FBI over the years, and this forms a pattern in the post 9/11 world. I think, you know, 14 or 15 out of the 22 so-called terrorist attacks have all those guys, the people blamed, had direct contacts with the FBI. So
exactly. Well, the other thing I found interesting, while they're blowing away black people in this country like nobody's business this week, one guy who was sitting in his car reading a book who was disabled waiting for his kids to come to the car just got killed in North Carolina's on fire with protests. Then another killing I reported on, the cop gave the guy literally 1 second before he shot him. And you look at the New York bomber, and they managed to shoot him in the leg, I think, and keep him alive. Doesn't that raise questions right off the top of your head?
Well, I think, I mean, and what you're seeing out there across these many cases is the confluence of like police paranoia and overtraining and training in such a way that it might not treat other people as human beings and these sort of things where it's like you're making snap decisions because you think your life's in danger. Yes, I understand that perspective, but you also have to understand the perspective that you shouldn't be shooting unarmed people in the process of being scared unless you're objectively faced with something that threatens your life. Right. So there's like a fine line. And I think that laws and lawyers get in the middle of all that and make it a purposely ambiguous area. And then symptoms of that are people being shot by people in authority all over this country. And it seems to be a growing trend, though. You also have to consider that there's a more you're more likely to know about it when it happens these days because of social media. So, you know, the internet age, we're getting a lot more information about what's going on. But, you know, these types of events, authority abusing the people that it's supposed to serve has been going on all over the world for a long time.
Exactly. And I mean, it's getting ridiculous. And it's like, you know, I'm looking at, you know, especially the people in North Carolina, you know, really going at it against the cops. The cops are hitting them with beanbags and, you know, rubber bullets and whatnot. What about the fact that under Obama, he's given the police department so much military equipment? Don't you think that changes the cops' mindset?
Well, it does. And some of the first things I saw when they shot that the terrorist from the New York, New Jersey bombings, as soon as you heard the fire department appealing for Homeland Security money and grants, and it was all about getting more federal money into those localities. And I said, that's like, I just reflected on looking at the big picture. It's like, look, people like George Soros and the Anglo-American establishment want America broken. They want us in a civil war. How are they going to do that? Well, they can put people, color against color and discrimination. You can put people of certain ethnic groups against the police and try to drive a wedge in that way. And what they're trying to do is break us up. And I think we all need to step back from the emotional nature of these events, look at it objectively. And it's like, these people will only exercise as much power as we let them, and they will only be as corrupt as we let them. So I think we need to make freedom a priority. And in order for us to get strength, we've got to give strength to each other and not try to take it away.
Right. Well, you got to look at, too, Donald Trump. Look at how much hatred and racism he's been whipping up to where, his supporters seem to be the ones that it seems when I get these nasty stories of people assaulting other people, setting a Muslim woman on fire, beating, two Muslim women in New York, almost toppling their baby carriage. How responsible do you think Donald Trump is for trumping up the hatred out there?
Well, I think that definitely Donald Trump is somebody who needs to be responsible for their actions, just like everyone else. But we also need to question the incendiary nature of the stories we're being fed on all sides. There's stories out there of the same nature that you're describing against Clinton and against Bernie Sanders and against, Jill Stein and, Johnson, Gary Johnson. I mean, so what we're all, again, it goes back to the concept of a second American Civil War, and that there's highly skilled people using propaganda to craft stories and to shade areas of truth to make everybody look like they're doing this thing to the other person. And I need to always remind myself not to get drawn into the media hubbub and all these things going on, so I can focus on my projects. But it has to do with, questioning the incendiary nature of a lot of what we're being spoon-fed and digging into it for ourselves. Like, if somebody says something about Trump or Clinton or anybody like that, I go to the source material and I start to look at it for myself and said, if I wasn't told that Hillary, passes out right there, would I think that she tripped? How did the Secret Service people act? What have you, right? The same thing with Trump. Like, Trump's got as many – I wouldn't put him on the same level with Hillary, but neither one of them, in my opinion, is qualified to lead a country of free people. Neither one of them is serving life, freedom, and happiness. And those are kind of the priorities that I have in my life. I appreciate life, but life's not worth as much as having life plus freedom, and life plus freedom equals happiness, in my opinion.
Right, right. Well,
they don't represent that.
Right. We're supposed to have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Well, you don't have to pursue it if you actually appreciate and defend freedom and practice intellectual and physical self-defense. It emerges as a result.
Absolutely. Well, we had quite a few incidents. It wasn't just New York. We had New York. We had New Jersey. We had stabbing in Minnesota, besides the cop murders. Do you think that these are all staged events? Not that they're not real events, but staged events to keep the fear going, or perhaps an October surprise?
Well, I wouldn't use the word staged. But I would use the terminology of gardening. I'm not surprised that plants are growing in places where they've been fertilized by intelligence agencies and other people who profit from the chaos.
Well, that's good. We can call them fertilizing events. I like that.
It's like they find weeds and they irrigate them. How about that? That's a better metaphor. They're like, oh, here's a good patch of weeds, and they irrigate it with our tax dollars. And then they're like, oh, we need more of your tax dollars to keep you safe from what we did with your other tax dollars. And that seems like a vicious circle of fraud and tyranny to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that they're still going to sweep Hillary or her body double or whatever else crap is going around online? Do you still think they're going to put her in office?
Well, I think the corporations and the status quo hope she gets to office. because, it's not that Trump doesn't have connections to the New World Order, and it's not like he didn't meet with Kissinger, and it's not like he didn't meet with Richard Haass, the chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, and it's not like Trump doesn't have a Rhodes Scholar in the form of former CIA Director James Woolsey as one of his senior advisors, right? So he's not that far from the thing that Hillary represents. It's just that everyone else knows Hillary represents it a whole lot better and isn't looking to make a name for herself. She serves power. That's why she is where she is. That's why all these events, like, mistakes in Libya and the fallout in Benghazi and all these other things, she can escape it because those other people in power that are surrounding her knows that she serves them.
Right. Absolutely. And I mean, the Clintons have quite the long history of criminal behavior, to say the least. And yet we have two people that probably Donald Trump has so many cases against him, and yet these people are still running for office. It's like we got the worst of the worst among us.
Well, one of the metaphors that I had drawn in one of my episodes of The Deep End was that if you're going to have a crappy player on one side of Wimbledon, you need to put an equally crappy player across the other side. Otherwise, you're going to notice that it's a rigged game.
Right. Well, do you think this is a rigged game, as Trump says?
I think it's a rigged game.
I think he's just in it to push it to her. And surprisingly enough, it looks like they're in a dead heat right now.
Well, I'll give you the general first, and the general riggedness of it is the Electoral College, where your direct vote for president doesn't really matter. And all those Electoral College positions are handed out by people in power in the party of power, usually. And the specific is that as soon as Donald Trump got into the race and like was the candidate against Hillary, that they won because they're like Trump. The only difference is Trump isn't an espoused internationalist or globalist. Hillary is. She's a world federalist. You can just Google Hillary Clinton plus world federalism. You can see her presenting the award to Walter Cronkite, and he's also a world federalist. So that's a primary difference between the two candidates. They both have a tendency or, a proclivity for irrationality, exaggerations, and all sorts of misunderstandings and talking about things that are will likely cause damage in a disconcerting way, and not do anything about that. So Trump, he's in favor of torturing people and all these things that have to do with the war on terror, not realizing that the war on terror is just it's a war on scare. They're scaring you to give you, give up your rights, give up your liberty, give up your family's freedom, your grandchildren's freedom for things that are very superficial and transient.
Right. Well, I saw on regular TV news how they were bragging about capturing the supposed bomber in New York because of all the closed caption televisions and surveillance in New York. So they're we're pushing it as what a great thing this is that we're watching every move everybody makes, but they didn't really talk so much about after he does the bombing, he just lays down in a hallway and waits for them to come pick him up.
Yeah, I mean, the news that I, was going across the tickers when I looked at it was, he was found asleep in the doorway of a bar. And then, was questioned by police and then got up, started to run away and started shooting. I'm like, this doesn't feel like, that's what happens in reality. Unless this guy was like, the Imad Salem, who was the guy who taped his FBI handlers in 1993 about the World Trade Center bombing. And the FBI had given him a real bomb and he was supposed to use a fake bomb. And they were having some contradictions there, conflicts. So maybe this guy who did these bombings, who had contact with the FBI a couple years ago, maybe he didn't go along the plan. Maybe he made himself easily found. I don't know what his motive was. I don't like that's going out there with our tax dollars, that they're right. Grooming the people that are causing all this havoc and chaos. They find it beneficial. I think once we take away the benefits for them doing that, then they'll act differently.
Well, looking at Hillary, looking at Trump, it just looks like we're going to be in trouble no matter what, okay?
It's just different flavors. You can have chocolate or vanilla, but you're going to have one of those two flavors.
I know, but, my thought is, and it's just my own belief, okay, my own thought, is that it would be more dangerous for Trump to become president than he realizes. because he can't be that stupid to think that he's going to be allowed to do anything he wants to do. And I don't think the people behind the curtain are going to take any crap off of him.
I definitely, you know, if he gets into, let's say he gets to be president, as soon as he appoints his cabinet, everything that Trump wants to do is going bye-bye, because his cabinet's going to be Council on Foreign Relations, people who support the Anglo-American establishment, people who follow the legacy of Cecil Rhodes' secret society to take America over, to merge it with the British Empire, and to take over the world. So the reason Americans participated in the plan was because it's a stepping stone to world power and them acting like gods and treating us like we're animals.
Like slaves. Well, you know, Jimmy Carter was a perfect example of that. You know, he came in with all kinds of promises, and then the CFR loaded his administration, and that was the end of whatever he thought he was going to do.
Yeah, but see, the thing is, in that case, and I don't know if it'll be the same case in Trump, but Carter was basically a stooge. He was used by Zbigniew Brzezinski and David Rockefeller, who plucked him and chose him, and the Trilateral Commission backed Jimmy Carter for president. And I believe this is in Barry Goldwater's book, With No Apologies. And it's chapter 33 is really good, but chapter 34 is where he talks about Rockefeller and Jimmy Carter and how it was a done deal before he even became president. So it could be that way with Trump. If you look at Trump's family history, I mean, he gets his money from his dad, Fred Trump, who is a real estate magnate. Trump's uncle, his name was John Trump, he became a custodian and the executor over Nikola Tesla's research and scientific writings after Tesla died in New York City. The government comes in, takes his safe, takes all the stuff. So there's all that. I mean, that's just, you know, the generations before. And then you can watch, you know, I think it was called Trump the Movie. There was a documentary on Donald Trump. And I got to say, like, no, if that's the worst about Donald Trump and you compare it to the worst of Hillary Clinton, I'm not going to vote for the lesser of two evils, because I don't believe in a system that, you know, your vote's connected to putting innocent people in cages and doing all these different things. But there's certainly a striking difference between the gangster history of Hillary Clinton and the gangster history of Donald Trump.
God. And this is out of 300 million people. These are the best we could find.
No, it's the people most useful to the Anglo-American establishment in creating the illusion that America is still a free country.
All right. Nothing is free in this country. Not even air is free in this country.
Nothing's really free in nature. You have to work for everything. So it's whether you're working in a system that uses a Rothschild-based currency, or if you're just, you know, working out in nature with natural law.
Right. Well, you know, sometimes you can get some oranges and lemons off somebody else's tree for free. So nature seems to be a much better place to be than reality. What do you think about this Uma Abedin, you know, Hillary's sidekick?
Well, I haven't really thought of her too much until I was we were doing a recent episode of The Deep End, and the Anthony Weiner story broke. And so we were talking about that. And at the end of the article, I learned that his wife was Huma Abedin. I was like, oh, that's that chick that works for Hillary Clinton. And then I started clicking other articles to figure out who is she, and why is someone who's a Saudi representative basically working so close to Hillary. And I just started to learn more and more. And I thought, wow, like Huma Abedin and Weiner were like a Bill Hillary clone couple, where, you know, the husband's off having his affairs or doing whatever, and this chick is the body woman of Hillary Clinton, and she's been very close to her since like 1996. And so it just raises all these questions about, you know, Huma Abedin said that she saw like Hillary using burn bags. And like, you know, there's been proof that Hillary banged up like a bunch of her phones with a hammer. And these things contradict what she told the FBI director. But the FBI director used to sit on the board of Hong Kong Shanghai Opium Bank Corporation, HSBC. And so they had given $81 million to the Clinton Foundation. So there's no conflict of interest there between the FBI director and Hillary Clinton in that questioning. But no one ever mentions this in mainstream media. So everyone's like, oh, look at them ganging up on Hillary. And it's like, no, it's a totally controlled, like, you know, kid glove situation right there. Right. And so I just, you know, I'm a fan of the bigger picture and not just the little piece of theater they're showing on the stage. I want to look backstage, side stage, what's going on over the stage, what's under the stage, and have a true understanding of the nature of our world.
Well, the nature of our country is something that needs to be put under a microscope these days because it's unrecognizable to me. And I have to tell you, Richard, that, you know, I live in a totally Republican town where everybody online has said they're voting for Donald Trump. But when I talk to the Republicans in town, and not a one of them wants either person. No one likes either choice, if you want to call it a choice. I keep telling people the only choice we have is Mexico or Canada.
Well, those are both beautiful countries, and I think we should all get along. I think there's various realms of oppression in basically every government that exists on the planet. And for a long time, it seemed like for at least some people, things were going pretty good in this country. And then, you know, the ideas of being able to be prosperous or to run your own business or be an entrepreneur, I think that was flourishing while it was useful to the globalists. And once they got what they needed, they put a damper on it. And these are the symptoms that you see when you see how far our country has changed in the past several decades. So I think what we're also seeing, these symptoms, the root cause goes back to, I could give you a variety of resources on this, whether it's Charlotte Iserbeat or Norman Dodd, who was a whistleblower. But the idea was that the Carnegie Foundation, Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundations, these big nonprofits, and this continues today with the Clinton Foundation, the Gates Foundation, you know, these are all intertwined. They wanted to merge our way of life with that of the Soviet Union, and that had to do with basically, you know, taking all the profitability out of freedom, taking away, whittling away all the free time and carefree lifestyle that you could have in a realm of freedom, and get it back down to you need every ounce of your work to survive, and it's run more like a gulag state. And what you're seeing with the rise of security and police and Homeland Security and all these other things, the federal agencies – giving money into your local areas and you don't have direct accountability with the people that are there running the government. There's all these little things going on. But what I've always tried to point out in my work is there's a single cohesive plan, working groups, funding sources, and it makes a lot more sense when you can actually understand how all these different layers interplay with each other rather than seeing it as a bunch of, you know, ongoing unrelated events and it's too complicated to understand. Because, you know, it's a finite planet. You know, things get pretty simple. There are people in power abusing their power, and they're only going to abuse their power more as we let them. This is a story of human history.
Absolutely. So what's your suggestion? I mean, here we have Hillary Trump, you've got Johnson, and you got Jill Stein running for office. I got to tell you, I'm not impressed. I wasn't a little more impressed with Jill Stein. Until she started slamming Bernie Sanders after she offered him the top spot on her ticket. So you kind of look at all of them as phonies and fairly ignorant people. That's the scariest part. I mean, I'm not going to say Hillary is ignorant because she's been, you know, a player in the scheme for so many years. But they're fairly ignorant people. You know, Gary Johnson, they're interviewing him after the bombs go off in New York, and he said, well, at least nobody got hurt. I mean, these people are so disconnected from reality. You know, and again, like you, Rich, I've been saying this to people since 2000. Your vote doesn't count. If it did, Al Gore would have been president, not Bush.
Well, and there's a Princeton study. I call it the Princeton Oligarchy Study, but it basically shows that there's no connection between the will of the people and what the government actually does. And like 85% of activities that government undertakes with the money they extort from everybody. So I don't call that that's not a healthy relationship.
No, absolutely not.
But just a quick point on Jill Stein. I saw what I thought was ironic and sad and funny all at the same time was there was a clip where Jill Stein was being interviewed and then like CBS or ABC or whoever edited it in such a way to change what she's saying. And Lee Camp on RT, he did a great little short video where he was showing this, and I sent it to my dad, and he's like, that was funny. He's like, that's sad, but that was still funny, you know? And so I think that the spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. And I think that the way that we can keep ourselves healthy is by having, you know, a sense of humor about this political campaign. Yeah, I think, I mean, come on, they're all jokes. We can laugh at it.
I know. I think actually I read an article yesterday off one of the major newspapers. I don't remember which one, to tell you the truth, that actually said that there's such an increase in depression over this election, depression, anxiety, people running to their shrinks. The unhappiness, the nervousness around this election is unparalleled. That's what, you know, professionals are saying.
Well, here's the flip side of that. So if what's going on out there is depression, here's the way to get a couple chuckles out of it. I have to sit around and wonder, what's the person you guys are going to vote for do to take away my freedoms? Because none of these candidates know how to build my freedom better than me, right? And so who's going to go out? You're going to vote for someone to go out there and make decisions on behalf of me who doesn't want to participate in that person who's all these candidates, they can't have high IQs. They're not intellectually competent in a variety of ways. Hillary, her biggest thing is she was incompetent with the server, but we should let her have the nuclear football where she could launch nuclear missiles and stuff. Like, that doesn't make any sense. If we take her and her campaign at their word that she was incompetent and wasn't doing anything illegal with relation to the server and the 30,000 emails and the classified emails that James Comey said went on, it's like if she's incompetent, then she's not qualified. And guess what? There are competent, hardworking, honest people in this country, and you're not seeing them in any of these campaigns. You have to ask why.
Right. Well, you're not allowed to. I mean, even to run locally, you know, I remember telling you years ago when I was approached by the Democratic Party here in Arizona to run for office. I said, well, what seat? And they said, anyone you want. But the first thing you have to do is you need $1 million.
Right.
I'm like, yeah, okay, let me just reach into my back pocket for that $1 million.
Well, they who print the money from nothing make the rules until you get to an understanding where you're not influenced by things that don't exist.
Exactly. Well, can't argue that. So we still, you know, we still get the Rockefeller pick. Speaking of the Rothschilds, I know you've got a new project going and you're just starting a new Indiegogo campaign to get it off the ground. What are you doing now? Are you putting together a book on the Rothschilds?
Well, first, I took interest, this is probably 10, 12 years ago when I read in Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope on it was like page 50 or 52. They talk about this Rothschild financial dynasty, this banking family. And I was like, gee, I just went through all this public school and university and, you know, economics classes. No one ever mentioned this to me. This is pretty interesting. So then I tried to look it up on the internet, and all I saw was a bunch of conspiratorial, poorly formatted, poorly referenced pieces of information. I was like, oh, they must not really exist. This is kind of like a blip on the radar, and I was going to move on. And then I kept running into their names in other books that I was using for research. So I was like, well, let me see what kind of validity and veracity and history is out there. And I kind of made it a hobby over, you know, the next decade to collect every autobiography or biography about the Rothschilds or written by the Rothschilds or, you know, any historical artifacts and documentation that kind of helped to flesh out this international banking family that has controlled world finance for the past 300 years. And again, I talk to people on, you know, work on Wall Street, and you know they're down there making money. I'm like, hey, have you ever come across the Rothschild family? You know, they look at you, they're like, no, we're like, what are you talking about? And so I was like, wow, this family that has all this influence and control sure does stay well hidden from the actual worker bees that are down here doing their thing. And so as I, you know, compiled all these books, I always wanted to take all the information that pertains to the United States history and kind of fills in the gaps where they've left out gaps on purpose in our education. And I finally had the opportunity past 2 years to start writing chapters chronologically using the best resources available, unless you have, you know, unless you're a billionaire, I guess. So I use the best resources available. And instead of it all being on my bookshelf and in my mind, I'm able to, you know, share it with others and they can find those books. A lot of them are used and you can find them relatively cheap. Some are very scarce. And I also try to tie that into research documents that are available on the internet because some of these books have been scanned in and whatnot. And so it's a mixture. So it's like a blueprint or a manual to the resources that exist and are pertinent to learning about the Rothschild banking dynasty. And like I said, there's a ton of American history that changes with that that piece of information, that that bit of knowledge. And it also ties in, of course, to the last will and testament of Cecil Rhodes and his goal to take over America, because he was funded by the Rothschild family, and his De Beers Diamond Syndicate was part of the holdings of the Rothschild family that we don't really ever hear about in American history.
Right. Well, we don't really get any real history, that's for sure. Rich, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the book. So stay with us, Richard, and I will be right back. I want to also give out the Indiegogo address.
Yeah, I didn't push launch on it yet, so I can send it to you like in a, you know, next half hour after the show.
Okay. So, you know, when you send it out, I'll give it out on the show tomorrow and put a link in tomorrow's show.
I sure do appreciate it. Thank you.
Hey, listen, we're all suffering. You know, this is why a lot of people are just walking away. I mean, nobody can afford to live in, you know, doing what I call independent media, not alternative. I don't want to be clumped into that.
Yeah, I'm not alternative. I'm independent. Looking all to right. stay independent. I don't want to be dependent.
Exactly. All right, let's come back, Rich.
All right.
Welcome back to Tragedy and Hope with my excellent co-host, Richard Grove. When I announced the show on Facebook, of all places, this morning, I did get some really good comments right away, and they said, everybody needs to hear what Richard has to say. Certainly, I'm the last person that's ever going to disagree with that. Takes me back, Rich, takes me back to after 9/11 when everybody ignored you except me. Let's get over to that, to your book. How much of the book do you have done? Because it must be a massive amount of work to put this together.
It's a massive amount of work, but what I didn't want to do is make a book too big that no one reads it. Like Tragedy and Hope, the book is like, you know, 1,300 pages and very few people read it.
Right.
A wise production in the past couple of years is Tragedy and Hope 101 by Joseph Plummer, which is like a cliff notes to Tragedy and Hope. And that is worth reading, and you can read it one afternoon, and it's about 200 pages. And I thought, wow, this is a great format because it's very consumable in a short amount of time. You don't have to wait 6 weeks to get done with the book, even if you don't have a lot of time. One afternoon, clear, you know, or one evening, you could probably get it done. And it's going to open up a whole new world that you can dig in and get all this really juicy factual knowledge that we were denied through public schooling. So right now, my book is 200 pages, double spaced in a PDF document. So that adds up to about $200 pages. Once it gets formatted and shrunk down into a Joe Plummer sized book, I would call it.
All right. Well, that's good because I agree with you. I mean, I got to tell you, somebody sent me a book last week with a ruler. It's 3 inches tall.
Yeah, I don't need to write a magnum opus. What I'm looking to do is get a useful manual of the resources that exist so other people, because I just feel like I've done all this study into something that's relevant to everybody. And unless I get other people looking at it, you know, it's just me and my buddy Kevin Cole really that focus on this specific line of research of, because this is where you get the Council on Foreign Relations and all these other things. So it's a deep study of the Anglo-American establishment, and the financiers of that establishment are the Rothschild banking family. So I think the book has, I mean, I don't have to check again, but it was like 18 chapters, and there was 2 chapters that I had to flesh out, and I did that research over the past year. So that's why I just wanted to start building a little momentum for it so I could actually get it into print and into people's hands. And then I've got a couple other books on the back burner that are actually less work to get into publication than this one. So if right. I can do this one, then right. I can do others.
All right. So what challenges are you facing to get the book to market?
Well, the challenge is always having enough time amidst other projects that I do that, you know, are how we make our income. It's like I do a show for subscribers only, just like you do a show for subscribers only. Mine's called The Deep End, Dive into Consciousness. And between filming and then editing that show, that takes up almost all of my time. And I'm still, you know, producing the Peace Revolution podcast and the last episode of that. That teaches you about the American involvement in drug smuggling from Barry Seal all the way up to 9/11. That was a 20-hour episode. So it took me like 6 months to do the research that's in that one podcast episode. But in that one episode, you basically have everything you ever needed to know about Iran-Contra, the drug smuggling, the CIA, how it really went directly to the White House. Like everything, every little piece of evidence that you would ever find relevant and necessary to understand, it's in that episode. So doing things like that kind of, you know, takes up most of my time. But I realized that, you know, this book is so close, I can just put, you know, a couple more weeks of time in there, get it proofread, get an index created, finish up the artwork and InDesign and things like this, and get it to market before the end of the year.
Great. So is the Indiegogo campaign to raise money to publish the book?
Yeah, it's for the publication of it and to get some copies up front in print. And I decided thus far that I'm going to self-print as opposed to going to a publisher. Just for, well, there's the entrepreneurial attitude of I can do it myself. And, you know, the resources to do that still exist at this time. So I'd like to try it because I think those resources are probably going to be more and more scarce. And I don't really need somebody to tell me what I can and cannot write for other people to read. So I like to cut out the middleman between me and my audience. And the other part of the fundraiser on Indiegogo is to fund the next interview in my film series, The Future of Freedom. And if you type Future of Freedom, William Binney, and on YouTube, you can find one of the interviews. So what I noticed is in making a documentary film, you're going to go out and film any number of people, you know, 15, 20, 30 people for a film. And then you're doing these long interviews with them. And most of it, all except a couple minutes, never gets out to the public. And I always thought that's kind of a big waste of energy. So what I'm doing, instead of trying to fund my film all at once, and you know, it takes a lot of money to make a documentary film, I think it's easier for both me and the audience to do it one component at a time. So what I'm doing right now is I'm going through my interview list and I'm performing interviews, filmed interviews on location as I can afford to do it. And then I turn that back around and give it to the audience. And now by the time they see the movie, it might be a year, year and a half from now, they'll still remember, that's right, this guy says this, but he also already gave me all his wisdom in these other interviews that I saw while we were doing production. So it's kind of a novel format where I don't see a lot of other people doing it, but I don't see why they wouldn't do it because it really enriches your audience. And that's the whole point. The person I interviewed, you want to hear the longer part of the conversation, not just the soundbite that fit in this movie script that had to be 70 minutes long.
Exactly. Well, you know, I'm thinking, you know, a DVD where you have the short film, the clips in the beginning, and then the long versions on the same DVD.
Sure.
Yeah, why not? You know, I interviewed a young man, a couple of months ago who did the same thing. He wanted to make a documentary, he put up an Indiegogo campaign. He raised the money as he was traveling around the country. It was on talking to people who are legitimately happy. It was called The Pursuit of Happiness.
Oh, right on.
And it was a great film. You know, I thought it was a great film because, you know, all we see is fear and nastiness out there.
Was there anything in common with the people who were happy?
Yes. The people that were happy were, I would say the big commonality was they were happy because they helped other people. They had purpose in their life.
They were giving strength to get strength. And it was exactly outside of the economic currency system. That's, you know,
exactly
everything you need, you don't really have to pay for. You know, you got to pay for some of these other things, conveniences, things to stay alive. But what you really need is a strong spirit and love for other people and your family and your friends. And these are the things that even in the absence of money, you can still be happy. You know, it just would be a little bit better if there was a little bit of funds to pay the bills. That's all, you know.
It'd be nice if we lived in a world where we didn't have bills and we didn't have to deal with money. Did I also read that you were going to interview, or maybe you have already, John Loftus for your film? Years ago. I think he had a book on the Nazi agenda in America, something like that.
He's like an unmined gem. I read his books. I'm like, every time I got to a page, I'm like, I got to interview this guy. And then I had the opportunity to go down to Florida. A friend of mine, actually, where we filmed the location of the doc of this interview, my friend had cancer and he passed away must be 6 months now. So I hadn't wanted to really go through that footage and, you know, because he's sitting in the background behind me while I'm doing an interview. And but I think now that, you know, I've had a little time to process it. It's good to I was digging into that footage yesterday and starting to put it together. So that footage will finally see the light of day. And what you're going to see is a man who was an attorney for the Department of Justice, who was a Nazi hunter, who found information because of his security clearance to let him see above American top secret records. So he could see top secret records of all the NATO countries that were participating in the post-World War II era, the Cold War, during the time of Operation Gladio. And he could see clearly how the United States was being manipulated by a foreign entity or a multinational entity, and how people who were senior in America's intelligence establishment, like John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles, were actually working on behalf of the Anglo-American establishment and betraying American interests and secrets and technologies and all this sort of stuff. And so I spent 5 hours going through most of the questions that I had that pertain to his books. And in my opinion, it's the most profound footage that I've had the honor and pleasure to capture on film.
That's great. I can't wait to see it. The War on Terror, which should be called the War of Terror. I'm sure he had plenty to say about that and the supposed ISIS, ISIL, whatever the hell you want to call them.
Well, and it's like, you know, I can watch what goes on in the TV a couple days ago, and the only reason I can, like, contextualize it and not have to really worry about it is because I understand the history of what I'm seeing on TV. And I don't like it, but I'm not going to be overly bothered by it where I can't do my work and function as a normal human being, because that would remove the benefit of understanding. Like, I can do that stuff if I'm in fear, but if you actually have the knowledge and understanding, you can go about doing what you have to do. And I think that's something that helps people break the trance with all this, you know, super urgent breaking story, breaking news, social media, MSNBC, all the CNN, all these big networks that are just like jamming media. I didn't ask for this stuff and you're showing it to me, you know? So there's that whole aspect, and you can sit back and look at it and say, oh, well, there's this whole history of how British MI6 groomed and funded the Muslim Brotherhood starting in like 1928 or 1927. And the spy's name was St. John Philby or St. John Philby. And he was the father of another famous MI6 spy, Kim Philby, who took this Arab extremist, they were fascists as well, they were fans of Hitler, network of spies and terrorists and useful underlings, and sold it to the Dulles brothers, who brought it into the CIA within the CIA. So during post-World War II, there was a State Department secret injection into the CIA. And these are the guys that brought the Nazis into the country, that ran Operation Paperclip, MK Ultra, all these sorts of things, while these other people in the CIA were actually hunting the Nazis that were coming into this country. Right. So, it's, you know, it's a hand in glove type of situation. We see historically the CIA as a glove, but there was this injection of the Anglo-American establishment that was serving the interests of creating NATO and creating and setting up a world government to take away national sovereignty, local accountability, individual freedom. And these are all things that they're the antithesis of what we want in this country. They're the antithesis of what people have fought and died for in this country. And yet without this knowledge, people are like, Alan Dulles is a solid guy, you know, and you have no idea that when you see these guys who are Islamic extremist terrorists or whatever that phrase they throw around is, they're groomed and trained by the intelligence agencies as a proxy force so that we'll invade places like Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan. I mean, Afghanistan is the longest war in American history. Let's just take a moment to think about that. Can anybody on the street tell you why we're in Afghanistan? How many hijackers allegedly were from Afghanistan? There's all these things that no one even thinks about, but what's in Afghanistan? Poppies. What do poppies make? Heroin. How's the heroin in this country? Oh, it's getting cheaper by the day. You know, where's it all going? Who's running that? Who's taking those billions of dollars? Oh, the Anglo-American establishment. They've been doing this since the East India Company. They just got America into the business after World War II. During World War II, American intelligence got in bed with the mafia. 1938, Operation Underworld. So Meyer Lansky, Momo Giancana, all these dudes are working with the government. They're working with the CIA inside the CIA. And Loftus talks about all of this.
But when you try to tell these stories to the average American, they think that you fell from another planet, you're insane, and they don't want to believe it.
No, I know how to read and fact check and coordinate. Like, I'm looking at the book across from me, Peace, War, and Politics by this journalist named Jack Anderson. So in like studying these stories and what's going on, you could come across journalists who were in the midst of it. And, you know, it comes out later in a book, or, you know, it makes it, you know, you only notice it after decades and decades. But there's been journalists that have been trying to educate people, but their you know, their resources were limited at the time too. But you can tell in hindsight, like, given what we know today, this is what they were pointing at. They might not have had it by the right name, but it's a methodology and an ideology combined to take away individual liberty. And I'm saying creating a path of ambition and understanding around getting that knowledge and understanding it and trying to figure out how they're doing it and how we can avoid getting done by it. I think that's what learning's for. Learning and reason is part of human survival in its essence. And they're trying to wipe it out. And they're treating everyone like idiots. So even if you're not an idiot, you're going to start acting like an idiot just to fit in with everybody else. And I think this is what Idiocracy was all about. I mean, I think Mike Jobs wasn't a prophet. I just think he saw the trends and he's like, wouldn't it be funny if? And 10 years later, America's like dumber than the people portrayed in that movie. And that's sad, but it's not irreversible. Like, it might be a terminal condition if left untreated, but I think it's definitely reversible with a little knowledge, wisdom, and understanding.
I have to agree with you. You know, I was thinking about you on the 15th anniversary of 9/11. You know, I saw somebody online today blaming 9/11 on Obama, that Obama didn't do a good job on 9/11. That's how stupid Americans are. But I could tell you that when I saw the tributes to 9/11 on TV at the gym, my anger came up like it was 15 years ago.
Well, I think when you look at why did 9/11 happen, like how was it able to happen? It happened because we as a nation became ignorant. We're not stupid, but in the absence of doing our homework and actually keeping a check on who's in power and how much are they getting away with, it got out of hand. And in the 90s, there's a lot of bread and circus for people. Even if you don't get the internet till the end of that decade, there was still plenty of TV shows and cable TV and satellite and all these other cool things that were coming out to keep people from paying attention to these people in power. How much money are they stealing and what are they doing with it? And then we came full on into the 21st century where it's like PNAC could write, hey, we need a new Pearl Harbor. And can we get this done? Can we get like 3,200 people to die in a place and get the whole country to go invade some place that had nothing to do with it? Because you can check out the, you know, decrypted purple code, the executive code of Japan, and you can see that MI6 and the fledgling OSS knew that Japan was going to do whatever they're going to do because they had imposed economic sanctions, right? And it's no accident that they get, you know, Japan to get into the war and get America into the war like that. And then the atomic bombs that were planned since 1928 got dropped over there, right? So, like, you're talking about mass murderers with printing money for nothing, and then you get it, they're getting all these other people to do, like, be their Renfields and do the dirty work and the hard work and the thinking work to build these awful weapons of war that should never be used on anything. But and you can only do it under the false story, because if they told us the truth, none of us or none of our families and generations past would have supported it. But you tell everybody untruth, they're like, okay, let's do that. You know,
right,
Churchill knew.
Exactly.
And this is not this isn't a secret in Britain. Churchill and these guys knew exactly what they were doing because he was in room 40 back in World War I helping to make sure that the Lusitania got sunk. Like, they knew where the German U-boat was the entire time since it left port, and it's all in the cables. And the cables are FOIA. You can buy books about it. You can see those documents. It's there. Right. So we're not using our capacity for intellect to inspire any sort of cognitive liberty until we stop and we start to think about how we can make freedom a priority in our life, because we sure do enjoy it. And when they want to punish us, it's the first thing they take away.
Exactly. Or they want to protect us. So they want to take away our freedom.
You don't need to protect me. Just secure everybody's rights and I'll be fine. That's what government's for, to secure our rights, is what the document says. So it's not about protection or giving you a safe space. If everybody's rights are protected and equal, we're all going to be okay.
Well, that's a whole big sentence there. If everybody's rights were equal, we wouldn't have all this back and forth hatred going on across the country, whether it's against gay people, transgendered people, black, white, the Muslim, Catholics. on and on and on. I've never seen a political climate quite as ridiculous as this one.
Well, no, because they've never had this much technology to point at people and, you know, make everyone attach their Skinner box, jump around when they send the shock, you know. But if you step away from that and you say, look, you know, there was a lot of racism in the 60s. And I remember seeing images and footage of cops using fire hoses and billy clubs. And at some point, didn't they firebomb like a city block in Philadelphia? Right.
There was, yes, they did.
Right. So these things have gone on in the past. And what did we hear? You heard Malcolm X. Right. You heard Martin Luther King. You heard people reading from Frederick Douglass. Right. Now, if you are like going out and doing these things in the street and, you know, all the ideas that those men embodied, Steve Biko from South Africa, who started the Black Consciousness Movement. If you're up on all those ideas and you want to go out there and do X, Y, Z, have at it. This is a free country and you're going to do what you got to do. But if you're doing that in the ignorance of what's going on, I mean, because I think everyone's getting played. There's a lot of Soros money and Anglo-American establishment money being invested into finding every crack in the veneer of American justice and liberty and equality and getting it in there and then fire hosing it to freeze it, to crack it even more. And I think that we need to understand, you know, and take some lessons in tensegrity, right? Like we give, if you are strong, then you give your strength a little bit to others and that makes them stronger and that makes it less work on you. This is the whole idea of self-reliance and self-esteem coming from being able to be capable in your own survival, in your own intellectual and physical self-defense. But they took those skills away. They took them out of schooling, and they're like, you don't need those. We need you to be a mindless cog in the machine, another brick in the wall, right? But I'm saying just because they took it out doesn't mean we can't add it back in of our own free will and volition. The internet also avails all these e-books, and you can get almost anything for free that, 50 years ago was very hard to find. And there's a reason that people write and use language. It's to make our lives better, not to make us into slaves.
Well, there you go. Born free. Remember that? Born free because your father was a doctor. But I think a lot of people in this country really have a very skewed idea of what freedom is. I don't think they have any clue what freedom is. Rich, hold on a second. Okay. My bell's ringing. Hold on. Rich, still there?
Yes, I am.
I heard a few beeps during the recording. He was probably trying to call. Tell me he was. But we're almost done, so I just want to come back and conclude because I want to put this up on Gary Noll's network, and then I'm going to put some of it up on YouTube. So let's just come back for like a minute. And wrap this up, okay?
Yep. No.
You might want to run it. Maybe they'll produce it, you know. And then my daughter worked with somebody in self-publishing, and the cost of her book came down really low, not very expensive. If you want, I could get you that guy's name. He'll do the layout, the art, you know, puts it all together, and it was fairly inexpensive.
Yeah, I'm going to try to do the layout and everything myself until I can't do something. Then I'll explore what options are available. I like to learn as much as I can, at least. That way I can have an intelligent conversation if I have to farm it out.
Oh, absolutely. But I'm talking about you might be able to get it done for less than, you know, between $3 and $7 a book if it's only 200 pages.
Yeah, right on.
So, you know, and then they get the ISBN numbers and all that bullshit, which is expensive to get. I only know because I had a publishing company. I closed that a couple of years ago. All right, Rich, let's come back and just I had said, hold on a minute, Rich. So I'm going to pick up with that. Okay, Rich, sorry for that little glitch there, but I had a glance at my doorbell. Richard, I'm very excited over your book and very excited over your new film. And I want people to know where they can find at you, tragedyandhope.com. Peacerevolution.org, is that correct too?
Yeah, that's correct. And you can also on tragedyandhope.com, there's a tab that says audio, and under there is my podcasts. There's a tab that says video, under there is most of the videos I produce. And then there's one that says links, and it's, you know, the YouTube link, the Twitter link, Facebook link that Lisa manages that page. I don't use Facebook, but I got a link for it, and there's some interesting posts, like one or two a week on current events and things like that.
It sounds great. Well, I'm looking forward to us doing this. You set to come back on the show in a month or two?
Yeah, sure. I love it. It's good to have an hour where I can relax out of a busy work day.
I understand. Okay, well, this ain't my hour, but I'm getting there. Thanks so much. A big hug to you and your family, Rich.
All right. Thank you so much, Maria, and to everyone listening.